Okay, so you know how it goes. The best laid plans. You're on the strict wonder vacation diet everyone's talking about. Gotta look good at the beach, right? And then one day, on the way to the gym, you stop by your neighbor's barbecue. You promise you'd pop in for a second. And then skinny, perky, made-up Shelly asks if you'd like a tiny slice of cake. She made it herself. Surely you can enjoy just the taste. Just a mouthful. An inconsequential bit of sweet confectionery goodness. What is the harm? She hands you over a piece of sugary temptation, and it looks just as moist and delicious as she promised, and you know you can't eat the whole thing, so your little fork peels off a tiny bit, and you bring that tiny bit to your lips and taste everything you've been missing for weeks, concentrated in a single thunderclap. Who knows what actually happened next? Memory's a funny thing, but the next thing you can recall is sitting under the bushes, shoving fistfuls of frosting into your mouth. Swimsuit season be damned. Oh, we know. We understand, and we do not judge. And that's why today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Slippery Slope. Slippery Slope. Amazing stories from real people where one small decision leads to something else entirely. My name is Glenn Washington. I'll be your host. But first, please do lift the chocolate from your fingers. Because this is Snap Judgment. Now then, Snap Judgment, Julia DeWitt is going to kick it off with an unlikely tale of what happens when a young fella from the heartland gets in slightly over his head. Snap Judgment.
So do you want to just start from when you first figured out that maybe something had gone wrong, and then we'll kind of...
Work our way back?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
This is Lee Sprague.
All right, I'll try. I don't like to talk about it. I'm from Wisconsin. I don't like to talk about myself, so, but I'll make an effort. You know, with Midwest people? I guess so, yeah. I wish it weren't mine, though.
Lee was a lawyer, married to a Russian woman named Katya. One day a while back, Katya and Lee decided to move with their kids to Russia, where Lee landed a job working for a guy we'll just call Oleg.
Oleg was a multi-billionaire. He was ranked, for most of the time when I worked for him, as the richest Russian on Forbes magazine. Assets of 20, 30 billion. You know, he was one of what's called the old guard oligarchs.
Is oligarch what people actually call them?
Yeah. They don't like to call themselves oligarchs. You know, they want to be called businessmen. And even in Russian, there's a word taken directly from English called businessman.
When Lee applied to work for Oleg's company, Oleg offered him a salary 5 times the amount he was asking for. But Lee was warned that that salary came with a price.
When I went over there, there was one other foreigner. And he warned me, you know, he sat me down and said, "You're not going to like this place. You're going to see things that, you know, compromise you ethically. See things that you feel like you should say no to, but you'll be forced to say yes." But he was ruthless. I mean, it was like working for... I wasn't in the army, but it was like basic training every day. Like, there are all these witch hunts. You know, he would get up in front of a room and yell and scream. He'd single people out, you know, fire them on the spot or belittle them. It was really sort of an intense, troubling atmosphere. You know, I hated working for him.
Why are we working?
Good question. I always thought of myself as a good moral guy. I'd held myself apart from the people I worked with for that very reason. Not that I was looking down my nose at them, but I considered my morals and ethics to be better than theirs. And I felt like I could just be a trusted advisor, you know, make some money and then escape.
Not long after Lee was hired, the financial crisis hit, and he had to help move millions of dollars around from one account to another. More and more, he felt like the business they were in was just one big shell game, and he had to play it. Got harder and harder to hold himself apart from the people that he worked with. As he helped shuffle these million-dollar piles of money around, Lee got to thinking. There was one investment in particular that only Lee and one other guy knew about, and it was rapidly losing value. No one would even notice if a little extra disappeared.
I sort of liken it to, you know, walking through the forest and seeing a pot of gold off the path or something. With that added component of it losing its value anyway, that sort of pushed me over the edge. My own little devil voice says, it's the answer to all your dreams, you know, all your festering anxiety.
To be clear, Lee was making plenty of money. His family wasn't wanting for anything. But sitting there at his desk, watching the money trickle away, little by little, well, it'd just be so easy to skim a little off the top. So that's when he decided. Lee was going to steal $10 million from Oleg.
I almost justified it, like I'm Robin Hood. Not that I gave to the poor. But it's easier to do something bad to a person you demonize. It made me feel less guilty.
When Lee and the guys he was working with were handling hundreds of millions or sometimes billions of dollars, it's hard to believe, but $10 million would hardly be noticed. Where that money would be noticed was in his bank account. So next, Lee had to figure out where he would put it.
I was using the tricks that I'd learned from how the oligarch did his business for my own little business. You know, I thought I could hide everything.
Over the course of a few weeks, using what he had learned on the job about how to hide money, Lee set up a Swiss bank account and a company in the Cayman Islands. The last thing he had to do was call for the wire transfer of $10 million.
I mean, that was crossing the real bridge of no return when I sent off that first email to the bank. They responded with, you know, one line. Sure. A day after that, I looked in my Swiss bank account and saw 10 with 6 zeros after it. I'm like, wow. You know, that day was, the day before was scary, but the next day was a good feeling. You know, I never, not like we were poor, but I'd never seen that much money in one place before. My wife didn't know, so I couldn't go out and be too blatant about it. I brought home a bottle of wine, and I said I got a little bonus at work. So it was just a bottle of wine, but then soon after I started getting this obsession with cars. Classic cars. I bought a Bugatti, I bought a bunch of Mercedes, I bought a Peugeot, where there are only five of them in the whole world. And I hadn't seen any of these cars, they were all just things I found on the internet. They were spread out all around the world, and I'd wire like $100,000 here, and then try and figure out how to get that car to California.
Lee and Katya were already planning on moving their family back to California eventually, so the cars were shipped ahead. And once the cars were in the States, Lee knew his money was safe. Katya eventually discovered pictures of the cars, and Lee had to cop to what he did. Surprisingly, she wasn't mad, and they started spending the money together. Katya wanted some new art, they planned a remodel of their house, and Lee kept buying new cars.
But then I did start worrying about money, which is a crazy thing. 300, you know, 500,000 on house renovation. You know, it started going down and down and down.
After the art and remodels, just the storage fees for those cars.
You know, you spend $1 million on cars and then you've only got 9 million. I started getting worried that it wasn't enough, basically. You know, and that's when I was really getting greedy, I guess. And that's why I went back for the other 5 million.
So Lee did it again. He called the bank and said Oleg wanted 5 million more dollars. And again, they said, sure, no problem. And then Lee took his kids on a weekend trip to Paris. When they got back, his wife was waiting for them on the front steps of their apartment.
You know, I could tell from how she was standing that something was really wrong. Like she had an unnatural look, like a brick was about to fall on her.
Lee's bosses had been calling. And then Lee remembered the incriminating paperwork he left on his desk. So in a panic, he rushed to the office to destroy the evidence.
You know, I sat outside in the car looking up at the windows. You know, I was shaking by this point. I had these nightmare images of, like, being thrown in a Russian prison. There are National Geographic specials and stuff that show them. Like, they're really awful. Then I went in. There was an entryway and then a guard who sat out in front. And I knew the guy who was sitting there, one of the few friendly people. And he was sort of my first line of defense. But I walked in, the guy smiled at me. You know, как дела, he asked, how are you? Хорошо, привет, you know, just normal talk. And then I relaxed and I walked through. I went up to my office, closed my door, turned off the light, and just sat there for a while. And then I turned on my computer, looked at my emails. And then, I mean, then I saw that it was what I'd feared. There were all these emails from different people, like the kind that you're scared to open, like the ones where the subject line is all in capital letters with a bunch of exclamation points. You know, I could tell just from scrolling through that it was really bad. So in pure panic, I started rushing around my office and grabbing up documents and smashing them into my bag. And then there was a knock on my door. I hid behind my desk, and I didn't even know if I had locked the door or not. Then nothing, nothing, quiet. Another knock. And then nothing. I came back out. I started stuffing documents again. Another 5 minutes probably went by. And then I heard a key turning in the lock. The door opened. The guy was, he was a new guy. He'd just been hired. I stood there and smiled and pretended to just be, I don't know what I was trying to do. He said, I didn't expect to see you here. Everyone's looking for you. So he asked me to come to his office. I followed him. Well, he picked up his phone and said, I'm going to call Oleg. And then, you know, I said, oh, I have to go to the bathroom. And I got up and started walking out the door. He said, don't leave, because he was suspicious, right? Sorry, I have to go. I'll be right back. And I went out the door and ran and ran and ran as fast as I could. He came out and he chased me down. It was a long hall. And he chased me down the hall. And he was screaming out, like, at the top of his lungs to the guy, the security guard at the front, like, останови его, stop him. He jumped up, but he didn't know what to do or why he was being yelled at like that. So I just ran out, ran through the foyer and out to my car. Like, I was just getting in my car when they both came out the door. And then I drove off as fast as I could, and that was that. And I just drove to the airport. Where else to go when you're a wanted man?
Why didn't you just go home to talk to your wife?
I mean, my fear was I would go home and then an hour later there'd be like 100 policemen and the oligarch security forces. And, you know, that would have been a huge mess. My kids would have witnessed all that, like me being hauled off. That's only part of the excuse, because I didn't even call her. I was too ashamed. I wanted to get out.
So without telling anyone, Lee sped to the airport. He ran up to the first desk he saw and got the next flight out to anywhere. Happened to be to Berlin.
When I first got on the plane to Berlin, it was like this feeling of relief. Like, I'm going to leave. This whole huge mess that I created is going to be behind me. My family will follow along. But then the relief turned into some like terrible anxiety. You know, I just could feel my life falling apart. Should have happened way before that, but that was when I first felt pangs of regret for stealing the money in the first place.
When Lee landed in Berlin, he emailed his wife and waited up all night for her reply.
You know, it was a hysterical email, basically saying she couldn't know where I was, she didn't want to know where I was, she hated me, all those things. Like, hard things to hear, but I guess I understood.
But still, Lee just thought he had to get to the States and he'd be home free. His family could follow him, they could start over. The next morning, he flew to L.A. But even though Moscow was now thousands of miles away, it was hard to get comfortable. Sometimes he was sure that he was being followed. To distract himself, he started preparing a house for his family. He even got his kids the dogs he promised them.
I'd walk them around the neighborhood, and when people asked me where my family was, I'd say, they'll be here soon. And I had a few of those old cars by then. I'd drive them around in the evening by the ocean, sort of imagining my boy sitting there next to me.
But while Lee was holding tight to that money and preparing for a new future with his family, his wife was back in Moscow filing divorce papers. And 2 months after he arrived in the U.S., Lee was served.
So, I mean, this is the part that's hard to talk about. The next day, I gathered what pills I had together. I made a little pile, and I realized it wasn't enough to do what I wanted to do. So I drove with my pills to my grandparents' house, and they were out, so I went in through the back door. And they had, like a lot of old people, they had piles of old pill bottles around. And I gathered them up and put them together with mine and swallowed them all down. Started driving home. And at that point, I still felt fine, because I guess they hadn't been absorbed. So I drove and drove. But sometime when I turned through Santa Monica down onto the PCH, I started not to feel so fine. And I kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I have just these little snippets of memory, like swerving into the opposite lane. I don't know how I made it that far, but in Malibu Town, there's one of the first stoplights on the PCH, and I stopped there. And then I felt arms on me, or hands on me, and they ripped me out. Like, I don't remember it all very clearly. But the next thing I knew, I was face down on the in the gravel on the side. And after that, I just don't remember anything. Until I woke up in a hospital bed. I mean, I wish I hadn't had to almost die to have a new outlook, but I woke up. I don't know. I mean, it's trite. I was happy to be alive. Determined to live. Determined to focus as much as I can on righting the wrongs I caused. And felt like I had a chance for some sort of redemption to do right again.
Once he got out of the hospital, Lee called Oleg directly. And even though Oleg was obviously furious, he wanted his money back. He put Lee in touch with his lawyers in America, and Lee started paying back the money. He moved home with his parents and got a job. His kids even came to stay with him for the summer. It seemed like things were on track.
And even in my worst sort of imaginings of all the possible outcomes, I didn't think of myself sitting in a U.S. court before a U.S. judge and waiting for a U.S. sentence.
It turned out that Oleg was under investigation by the FBI, which means attention was drawn to Lee. And the FBI didn't care if Lee was trying to undo what he did. Lee was living with his parents when he got the email. The feds were moving to indict.
To this day, I resist saying that it was about greed. But it was. Yeah, I fell down the slippery slope.
Do you think of yourself as a bad guy?
I do. I justified what I did by demonizing him, by setting myself up as a good guy and him as bad, and telling myself I was stealing from a thief. So that doesn't sound so bad, right? But over time I realized that by stealing from a thief, I'd become a thief too, just like him.
When I caught up with Lee, he was living in an apartment in Beverly Hills. It was Thursday when I did this interview. On Monday, Lee was going to federal prison.
My lawyer said I'm actually going to a really high-level place, but I think she's wrong. I hope she's wrong.
I figured Lee would be busy in his last few days seeing people, but he said no. His schedule was pretty wide open. Not many people to see these days. His apartment was empty, just a couple of couches and a TV. His kids are still back in Moscow. He won't get to see them before he goes in.
What do you tell your kids now then about stealing?
Not much.
All of these cars, the Bugatti, the Peugeot, the Corvair, all $1.4 million of them had been repossessed by the FBI. He had to borrow money from his parents just to cover basic amenities in prison.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming.
At the end of our interview, Lee walked me to the garage and watched me as I pulled out. I saw him wave goodbye in the rearview mirror. In a few days, his mom was going to drop him off at prison. As of the air date of the show, Lee has 49 months to go.
Stay strong on the inside, Lee Sprague. Stay strong. The piece was produced by Julie DeWitt and Mark Ristich, with sound design by Leon Morimoto. Now, when Snap Judgment comes back after this break, we come back hard. A player shows us that you don't need money to get the girl, and in one of the most sacrosanct areas in professional sports, please know the fix is in. All that from Snap Judgment, the Slippery Slope episode continues. Stay tuned. Today's Snap Podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe Home Security, the smart way to protect your home or small business. With 24/7 protection and emergency response, Simply Safe makes sure help is there when you need it most. Tech experts at CNET call it better, smarter home security. There is no annual contract, and around-the-clock security monitoring is less than you'd imagine. Peace of mind has never been easier. So get your award-winning wireless alarm system from Simply Safe today and enjoy a special 10% off when you visit simplysafesnap.com right now. That's simplysafesnap.com. Simplysafesnap.com.
Thanks for listening to Snap Judgment. Check out the Fresh Air podcast. Fresh Air interviews are a great way to get to know people like Jon Stewart, Larry David, Amy Poehler, Louis C.K., Michael Keaton, Bradley Cooper, and the creators of shows like Mad Men, Better Call Saul, Justified, and House of Cards. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Snap, the Slippery Slope episode. This next story, I'm not going to lie, this next story horrifies me. It does because it attacks the fundamental sacred pillars of my childhood. Snappers, the truth is hard. The truth. Charles Farrell, he recently decided to start spilling the beans.
I started watching boxing when I was extraordinarily young. I was probably no more than 4. And although this is going to sound kind of silly, I was intrigued by the products that were sold between rounds. And one of the primary products were cigars. And I actually smoked cigars from the time I was 4 until I quit when I was about maybe 9 or 10. So I sort of became infatuated with the whole atmosphere that surrounded boxing. I wound up, by the time I was in my late teens, doing a lot of boxing betting. You know, that's illegal betting. And I found that almost inevitably I could tell you who would win a fight and how they were going to win the fight and what was going to happen. I understood boxing at an incredibly visceral level. And so when I started managing, I assumed that that was all that I would need. But very early on, I realized that it would be very, very difficult to move fighters without fixing their fights. It is surprisingly easy to fix a fight in boxing. You will go into a gym and you'll find a trainer or a manager, someone whose reputation is that of providing what they call in boxing business opponents. Opponents are guys whose livelihood is dependent on their losing on cue. And what you do is you don't say things that are indictable. That's really what it comes down to. You don't want to criminalize yourself if you can avoid it. And you'll say, I have a fighter who needs to get some work. And work is the operative word here. It means that you don't want him to do anything that's going to be too strenuous and that's going to risk his losing. And you're probably talking about a knockout. And he'll say, okay, I've got a guy who's a good fighter, but he's not in shape. He hasn't been in the gym much. He's got a job. He's probably good for 4 rounds. Okay, so at this point, what you've done is you fix the fight and you fix the duration. What you can do further is fine-tune. And with almost no exceptions, the fight will take place exactly as it's been outlined. And sometimes you can get nearly to the second the result that you need. One of the reasons that you fix fights is that the minute you undertake to manage people, they have lives that cost money. They have needs. And so you want to move your fighter as quickly as possible through the ranks into title fights, money fights that will actually make everybody involved real money. And so, you know, I would say initially my interest was almost entirely economic. I don't think I had any real scruples about that. But what's interesting is the more I learned, my reasons for fixing fights broadened because fighters spend their lives getting hit in the head by people who hit incomparably much harder than anybody that you'll ever see on the street. And it doesn't necessarily show up right away, but inevitably they suffer from neurological damage. And so fixing the fights allows fights to go very, very short distances, and nobody gets hit nearly as much. So as I got more immersed in the culture of boxing, I had fewer and fewer scruples. And by the end, I had very few. An example of why is Leon Spinks. Leon Spinks was a gold medal winner who very, very improbably in his eighth pro fight won the heavyweight championship from Muhammad Ali.
1978, Hilton Pavilion, Las Vegas, Nevada, and Leon Spinks, a bare amateur really, with only seven fights behind him, wrested the crown from Ali.
Suddenly he's got a ton of money, and he's a guy who has no concept at all of how to hang on to money. So 7 or 8 months later, he loses the title back to Ali, and then gets knocked out in the first round of his very, very next fight and slips into a kind of, you know, he's the punchline of a lot of late night TV jokes, which is a shame. He shouldn't be. But over the years I'd managed, I'd built a very, very solid reputation. I was able to bring back fighters in a way that would make them marketable again. And so through a series of unusual events, I wind up with Leon Spinks. You know, I don't necessarily want to manage him, but there he is. And I find out that I can get him a fight in China for what's not big money for him during his heyday, but it's $175,000. But in order to do that, I have to raise Leon's profile a little bit again. And the way I do that is putting him in a fight at the DC Convention Center, where I know we can get a quick knockout, and then I can set up the thing in China. And everybody involved could make some money for a little while, myself included. But this Leon Spinks reclamation project was a very, very tough sale job because people understood that his best days were long since behind him. And my associates would say, Charles, are you sure that we can do this? These are, you know, TV people, they're promoters, agents. And I would reassure them. I would say, yeah, if you let me handle all of it, if you let me handle the matchmaking, if you let me call the shots, I'm confident that we'll all make money here. The problem is I had a guy who couldn't pass the CAT scan. The District of Columbia wouldn't pass him as an opponent. So I invented an opponent. I made up a guy. And it was a friend of mine. He was a trainer of my other fighters, a guy named John Carlo. Problem is, he's never fought before in his life. And of course, no commission would sanction a fight between a guy who's never had one fight and a former heavyweight champion. So I wound up making up a record, which was very difficult to do, for John Carlo, comprised entirely of names of real fighters, but fighters who are sort of veteran loser types. So it would be almost impossible to tell whether these fights really took place or not. And even the fighters themselves, who were busy losing fights, wouldn't remember. Anyway, John Carlo, a couple of days before the fight, calls me up and says, you know, what happens if I beat him? And I could have fixed the fight. So if I said, you got to lose, you know, in the first round, he would have done it. But I didn't say that. I said, you've never fought before. You can't possibly beat Leon Spinks. I said, you know, Leon's not what he once was, but he was the heavyweight champion of the world once. So, you know, if you can beat him, beat him. But I was completely confident. The Washington Post did a feature article on Leon the day before the fight. We did some live radio sports shows. So there was a big crowd. We had a really charged up arena. And I have seldom seen anybody in the dressing room as loose as Leon Spinks. You know, this was a kind of triumphal return to mainstream boxing. Don't call it a comeback. And I was very pleased to see that he still looked like a fighter. And I remember John Carlo calling me and saying, you know, I didn't realize he was such a muscled up guy. And what he really thought is, I'm going to get knocked out by the guy who beat Muhammad Ali. And that in and of itself is an honor. So by the time Leon and John hit the ring, the crowd was in this kind of party mood. And I thought, okay, everything is under control tonight. The bell rang, and Leon, as was his custom, kind of tapped gloves with John in this very friendly, fraternal way, which John accepted. And then he went to do it again. What I didn't understand is that John Carlo was one of these rare guys who, when he panics, rather than folding, he's galvanized. And John stepped in with an absolutely picture-perfect left hook. Hit Leon right on the jaw, and Leon went straight back in this very dramatic, high-impact way and hit his head. And of course, I'm right there. And I said, oh, Jesus Christ. I felt just incredible shock. Of all of the things that I thought might happen, that never once had entered my mind as a possibility. I mean, he was done. Somehow Leon beat the count. I don't know how. And I was trying to signal to the referee from ringside, that's it, stop the fight. But the referee, who couldn't believe what was happening, didn't step in. And John Carlo did this total demolition job on Leon Spinks. So ultimately, the fight only lasted maybe a minute and a half, but it felt like an eternity while it was happening. And really what I felt was a sort of horror, because I understood that these were just really hard punches and that I had guessed very, very wrong about Leon, that he really shouldn't have been hit at all by anybody. And of course, the crowd was furious. They had assumed that I had fixed the fight for John Carlo's benefit, and that John Carlo was my fighter. I felt like an idiot. I could have fixed the fight, and I still don't know why I didn't. It was an incredibly unnecessary mistake. At the very least, it cost us a $175,000 payday in China. But it actually did more than that, because it caused Leon Spinks more neurological damage, which was something he did not need to have. And, you know, I really tried very hard to make sure that Leon didn't fight again. But the next day, I was sitting in a restaurant in the hotel where Leon was staying. And I had a business associate with whom I was talking. And a lot of business had gone wrong for us that night. And we were trying to figure out what was what, whether we could salvage anything. We sort of knew we couldn't. And it was not a pleasant experience. And while we were talking, Leon came up to me. And Leon is a very shy guy. And he essentially didn't get into my orbit until he kind of had permission. And he came in and he asked me, can I get a rematch, Mr. Farrell? I can do better. And I said, no, Leon, this is not going to be a rematch. And it was difficult. It was an embarrassing situation, because it's something I would rather have not talked about with anyone else around. And I could see he didn't want to be there. And he said, can I get some money for something to eat? You know, I pointed out to him that the hotel was covering all the tab. He could eat at the hotel, but it wasn't what he wanted. He wanted to be by himself and take care of things. And, you know, money is money. And when fighters ask for money, and fighters always ask for money, you're talking about, you know, $100, $50, $200, something like that. So I said, what do you need? And he said, can I get $5? And I gave him some money. And he left. And that was it.
Charles Farrell left boxing a few years back. He's since returned to his other love, music, and a new love, writing. We'll have a link to his Deadspin article about why he did what he did on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece is produced by Joe Rosenberg with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Snap Judgment returns. Just because you're homeless doesn't mean you can't pull the honeys. You heard me. Snap Judgment, the Slippery Slope episode continues. Stay tuned. Support for this show and this message comes from PicMonkey.com, an online photo editor that is super sorry for being a promotional message right now, because what they want to be is your favorite photo editor. Whether it's a picture, a design, a collage, you can make it real nice with PicMonkey. It works right in your browser and is so powerful. You'll be all like, are you serious, PicMonkey? And they'll be like, yeah. For a free trial of the premium features, check out picmonkey.com/snap.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads other people's journals? Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
From PRX and NPR, welcome back to The Snap. My name is Ben Washington, and today we're in the business of riding a very slippery slope. It's about decisions. Decisions. One small, seemingly inconsequential decision can change the course of everything. Even love. Especially love. And for this next piece, sensitive listeners and those with small children should be advised it does contain sexual content. Caitlin Prest brings us a story about a guy looking for freedom. And freedom comes hard.
I met Keith Ford in a coffee shop. He looked a little bit like Basquiat. He had a kind of anti-establishment air about him. He'd make me cappuccinos, and I'd linger at the counter chatting and laughing and wondering if he had a girlfriend. We started to have long conversations about his crazy life in Cleveland, Ohio.
I was living in this, I guess you could call it like a DIY or punk house. I don't recall exactly, but I'm pretty sure I got kicked out. That first night, I still had my truck, and I remember parking it on a lakeside street and just like listening to the lake crash on the beach. And there was kind of like the attitude of like, well, I don't have anywhere to go, but that means I'm free. Being free from responsibility, free from financial burden, that I could just wake up and brush my teeth using a bottle of water go out and see what the day had to give me, which was basic stuff like, where am I going to eat? Can I take a shower today? Am I going to take a bath in Lake Erie?
This lifestyle seemed to suit Keith. Most people never even realized he was homeless. He was young, he was well-spoken, and more often than not, he had a girlfriend.
I think it might be hard for someone who's never been homeless to imagine someone without a home getting into a relationship. But for me, like, getting into relationships, it's always been pretty easy. I'm able to carry myself in a way that is often in opposition of my present circumstance. If I'm utterly desperate, you wouldn't know that because I don't carry myself that way. I smile often, I laugh often, I tell jokes, I'm upbeat. It's easy to fall in love with me.
Girls would fall in love with Keith all the time.
So many different circumstances, so many different women, so many different states. Dating this girl that I liked at the time, came here and started to date this woman, like Earth Goddess. She had a great apartment in Brooklyn. Who would let me live in her house instead of sleeping on a bed? Found out that's how I was living. She was like, no way, man. You can crash at my house anytime.
He spent a lot of his homeless days living in apartments with girls he met.
At the time, I thought I was just in a relationship, you know? So if I stay at your house overnight, it's not because I have to. Because you invited me. But it's also kind of like, you probably shouldn't have done that. Because I totally took advantage of it. Like, it's an imposition.
These romances had a pretty short shelf life. They'd break up and Keith would be on his own again, looking for a new place to stay, a new situation, a new girlfriend. He train hopped from town to town, which is how he wound up in Rochester, living, once again, on the street.
I was sneaking into the basement of this row house. But the basement was the most frightening place I had ever encountered. When I opened the door, there was like this like exhalation of air. It was just like, oh. And I was like, oh my God, I don't want to sleep here. I do not want to sleep here. And because I was so scared, I slept on the stairs. Like sitting up. You know, I did that for a couple nights, maybe two or three nights. I'd stopped in this cafe because I was like kind of at the end of my rope. There was this woman there who I had seen around. She kind of looked like Mariska Hargitay from Law and Order SVU. And I've always had a crush on that woman, so I was sold. I'm just kidding. You know, she invited me to sit down at her table. And she's like, hey, we just kind of had a conversation over coffee. I saw her again at a grocery store. And she was like, oh, hey, Keith, you know. It's kind of funny because I was in there stealing food. Putting cookies in my backpack. And one day she invited me back to the coffee shop. And that's when she kind of told me, like, husband's in prison. They took my kids. I don't have a job. I don't trust a lot of the men that I meet because they're not genuine, and you seem like a genuine person. She was like, do you want to come back to my apartment? And I was like, yes. Her house was kind of like this house, like old. The bathroom is like this huge window. It's letting the sun in, and it's got this like black and white checkered tile on the floor. I'm like getting undressed to get in this shower with the feet in it, you know? She kind of just came into the bathroom and was like, I brought you a towel and a washcloth. And I went to the store, I bought you a toothbrush, some toothpaste, because I don't share my toothbrushes. And I was like picking up on like something, like why would you buy me a toothbrush? As she's like putting these things away, just very like nonchalantly, she was like, you know, like, I want you to stay here. You don't have to keep telling me that you're gonna go back to your apartment. Like, I know that you don't have anywhere to live. So if you wanna stay here, you can stay here. But you have to have sex with me. And I was like, yeah, I can do that. What's wrong with sex? And the first time was cool. I was way into it. She had a great body. She really liked me. We talked about it afterwards. We smoked cigarettes. She made food. I slept there next to her that night. Being able to sleep in a bed was nice. God, there was like two windows next to it, right? So the sun would come in the morning. She had a lot of pillows. I'd start brushing my teeth regularly. And it just went on like that for a while. You know, I was happy. But over time, that changed. One time she gave me $20. And I suddenly felt like uncomfortable. That meant that the exchanges that we were having weren't... There was a obvious... She never intentionally made me feel like her plaything or her possession. That was something that I felt all by myself. There was a point when we were with a group of her friends and we were sitting at a table and she got up to go to the bathroom and I remember there was a voice in my head that was like, you are gonna have to have sex with that woman. And shame came up inside of me. Over time, I came to dread just interacting with her. I would avoid going out with her in public. I would always like make up some excuse. I couldn't let on that I wasn't happy, right? Because then the whole, the whole rationale would come crashing down. We'd be lying in bed together. She's asleep. She rolls over and puts her arm across me, and I feel disgusting. Like, don't touch me. Ew. I don't want to be here. I don't want to feel your skin on me. She just wasn't pretty anymore.
Do you remember the last day you were there?
Yeah. Yeah, we were having sex, and the bathroom door was open, and I was staring into the bathroom. And then I, like, leaned my head over to meet my own eyes in the mirror. I remember thinking, I don't want to do this anymore. It didn't feel good. It didn't feel right, if that even means anything. I kind of spaced out. I just kind of went away. And then I had put my clothes on. I remember she stayed in the bed and just watched me get dressed. And I said, what? To her. And she said nothing. It wasn't like a big catastrophic blow up or any real conversation. It's just one night I didn't go back. That experience almost dehumanized sex for me. I regretted it. It's like a part of my life that I would like to not think about.
Afterwards, did you have like a little bit more perspective on your situation? Like, you would think that you would have a desire to, like, get a job and get your own place.
Yeah, you would think that.
But yet you didn't. Like,
no, I did not. You would think. Any normal person would want their own... My brain doesn't work that way.
Do you have anything more to say?
Nothing that should be recorded.
Everything should be recorded.
Will you make love to me one last time?
No.
That's the part I didn't want to record, is you saying no. Now there's a record of it.
Big thanks to Keith Ford for sharing his story. That piece was produced by Caitlin Prest and Joe Rosenberg, with sound design by David Kim. It was adapted from Caitlin's killer podcast, Audio Smut. It's a show that takes a refreshingly unflinching look at matters sexual And it has some amazing stories, which you will never, ever hear on public radio for obvious reasons. But that just means you should go listen right now. Download it from iTunes or wherever else. Great stuff is given away for free. You've done it. The best and wisest investment of your time you could make. But don't stop there. Don't stop here. No. Oh, no, 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 no. One bite of the apple is never enough. You want some more Snap Judgment? Subscribe to the podcast, my friend. There is no time like the present. Full episodes, pictures, movies, the podcast, and secrets. Real secret stuff that awaits you right now. SnapJudgment.org. Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. The Snap was produced by myself and the slipperiest, slidingest, slopiest team in all of storytelling history. Please say hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Cedi Miller on the ones and twos. Julia DeWitt, she sings the blues. Anna Sussman blows her tuba horn while Joe Rosenberg delivers a storm. Nancy Lopez, she digs the beat. Rizzo Gorio, he digs the heat. Davey Kim adds the jam, tapping in, rapping that big, big bang. The Snap Snap Singers, Leon Morimoto, Anna Aberstein, and Aurora Soria, they keep the place hopping. Glorbina, who have the broccoli and beef, hold the salt, hold the hot sauce, and hold anything else you may be thinking of adding. Now, if you are thinking of hacking the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, I would advise against it. No need. Here's a pro tip. They have a special meeting where they give away all their secrets every Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. It's not very well attended. Have a seat in the back. You're welcome. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, is always trying to exchange public radios for three magic beings. Don't let them get over on you. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago has a lot of magic beans from PRX. We tried to warn them. Blame Ira. And though you may have ascertained that this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, even though the official national news ombudsman of the Associated Guild recently declared in a 243-page report that Snap Judgment is unequivocally not the news at a press conference where we sprayed him with both water and BB guns, even that is not as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.